Hello, my name's Jim Roberts, and I'm a senior claims director in the UK Defence Club. In this podcast, I'm going to be speaking about shipbuilding contracts and some of the developments and features that we often see in them. Now, shipbuilding projects are a significant investment, and it's essential that contracts are put together carefully, with a particular eye on the specifications and detailed provisions to avoid, as far as possible, uncertainty and ambiguity. The shipbuilding industry has faced many challenges over recent years. Changes in the market, technological developments, and an evolving regulatory environment all have the potential to trigger issues in relation to new building projects and the associated contracts. In this publication, the club takes a look at some of the issues that potential buyers should be aware of, as well as the legal pitfalls to be avoided when entering into new build contracts. Let's start by looking at ship design and specifications. The buyer will normally provide specifications for the ship, but the design itself is typically developed by the builder. Specifications and detailed drawings and plans are normally incorporated into the contract itself. Regarding design risk, it's sensible for the parties to make express provision for the allocation of design risk at the outset to ensure as much clarity as possible to allocation of responsibility. Certain standard form contracts place design responsibility expressly on the builder, for example, the BIMCO New Build Con. The Shipbuilders Association of Japan form, however, notably does not contain express references to design risk. The China Maritime Arbitrations Commission form adopts a hybrid approach, stating that the seller agrees to design, but pursuant to a design undertaken by a third-party designer based on the buyer's requirements. That form can create potential difficulties for a buyer should a design problem come to light. Express provision is made for the allocation of design risk. English law normally places a responsibility upon the builder to ensure that the ship is built to specification, including any performance criteria, and that the ship meets certain safety requirements. Case law has confirmed that as a matter of English law, the Sale of Goods Act implied terms, such as fitness for purpose, will be incorporated into a shipbuilding contract, except in the absence of very clear words of exclusion. However, there are scenarios where this could be displaced. Contractual wording could be used to limit the scope of the builder's workmanship standard. Further, if the original design had been provided by the buyer, then the builder's position in rejecting liability would be stronger. A potentially problematic area concerns the interplay between different sets of initial designs relating to the ship and her equipment. For example, in the scenario of a pipe-laying crane barge, the crane and the barge itself may be designed by different organisations. Care must be taken to ensure that there is compatibility between the respective designs, and there should be a clear allocation of responsibility for any design issues that may result. Similarly, care needs to be taken by the buyer when agreeing terms relating to ongoing buyer approval of plans and drawings. Normally, the right of the buyer to approve the plans does not cause a transfer of design liability back to the buyer, but it's wise to express this explicitly. Otherwise, the buyer is likely to be faced with arguments that it is a stop from asserting any design flaws. Now, let's look at the question of modifications. Generally, the parties can agree modifications to the specifications by making consensual contractual amendments. Standard forms display different approaches as to the ease of adopting the buyer's and the builder's modifications and how much discretion contracting parties have to refuse consent to a proposed modification. The SAJ form, for instance, allows a builder to refuse the buyer's proposed modifications, although any such discretion should not be exercised unfairly. The New Build Con form, on the other hand, provides a mechanism whereby a buyer can challenge a builder's refusal to undertake a modification. Modifications will often require corresponding changes to the delivery date, the contract price, and other contractual terms. If the parties do agree a modification, it is vitally important that such consequential amendments are addressed adequately and expressly, with the agreement being clearly recorded in a contractually compliant form. Arbitration tribunals have in the past rejected builders' arguments that modifications provide automatic extensions to the delivery dates without express agreement. However, it is preferable to avoid any ambiguity. A more difficult situation arises if the parties are unable to agree the time and price consequences for a modification sought by the buyer. Again, it is desirable to incorporate express contractual provisions stipulating a mechanism for the resolution of such a dispute. For instance, the new build conform has a provision for expert determination, or indeed arbitration, in this type of scenario. Even in a case where a buyer has the right to impose modifications on the builder unilaterally, the builder must give consideration to the knock-on contractual impact. For example, will the buyer itself lose rights should it fail to provide the builder with a reasonable extension of time in which to address modifications? Case law has stated that even in the absence of an express provision, the buyer must cooperate with the builder to agree price, performance, and delivery terms, or to suggest a way forward in the event of a buyer-proposed modification. There has, however, been some discrepancy in the approach of the courts and tribunals to this point. Now we turn to quality control. Quality is clearly of paramount importance. Appropriate provisions must be agreed in the contract in order to determine how the quality is to be verified and what should happen in the event of dispute. In this connection, sea trials are a crucial step in the life of a new build. Deficiencies almost inevitably do come to light during trials. On completion of the trials, any defects are to be put right and the ship is to be made deliverable. The ship is deliverable when she is in such a condition that the buyer is under a contractual obligation to accept her. What is required, as a matter of law, for a ship to be deliverable can be a troublesome question. Answering it requires consideration not just of the terms of the specific contract, but also frequently of the terms of the English Sale of Goods Act, for example, dealing with compliance with description, satisfactory quality, and fitness for purpose, unless, of course, the parties have expressly excluded these. For reasons of self-protection, to avoid results being rendered conclusive by their absence, the buyer's representatives should attend the trials. Accurate and complete notes should be kept of trial results, particularly if there are matters of concern. It can pose serious evidentiary problems in subsequent hearings if contemporaneous records are incomplete. Normally, after presentation of the results of the trial, the buyer has a short specified amount of time in which to decide whether to accept or reject the ship. If the buyer makes no decision, then it is generally deemed to have accepted the ship. Some contracts make express provision for such deemed acceptance. If the buyer does accept the ship, then the buyer is committed to taking delivery of the ship when tendered. Delivery normally takes place at a scheduled meeting when delivery documentation is provided against the payment of the delivery instalment. However, acceptance of the ship does not mean that the buyer is deprived of remedies should defects in the ship come to light. Instead, shipbuilding contracts normally provide for a complex warranty framework. Let's consider the nature of these warranties. Typically, the builder provides a warranty for the ship, her machinery and equipment for a fixed period running from the date of delivery and acceptance. This is frequently a period of at least 12 months. See, for example, Article 9 of the SAJ form or Clause 35 of the New Build Con. During this time, the builder will rectify deficiencies at its own expense, but incidental losses arising from the defect or repair are usually at the buyer's risk. The Norwegian Ship 2000 form is somewhat more generous to the buyer, in that it allows for claims in respect of consequential damage to other parts of the ship. Crucially, loss of use or business interruption losses are normally for the buyer to bear. This is frequently an area for dispute, which can be minimised by the use of clear and precise contractual language. As to scope, the builder typically warrants the quality of material, workmanship, and often design, though this may vary if design has been provided by the buyer or undertaken by a third party. Recent English case law has tended to adopt a more pro-shipyard approach, resisting arguments from buyers to extend the scope of warranties. The courts have taken care to confine the scope of warranties both as to content and to time. Thus, in the case of Neon Shipping and Foreign Economic and Technical Cooperation Co. of China, the court held that the buyer could not circumvent a 12-month time period for warranty claims provided by the shipbuilding contract. The buyer sought to bring claims some 2 years after the expiration of the warranty clause, arguing that the time limits applied only to those claims brought directly under that clause and not to those brought under other contractual clauses. The court rejected this argument, maintaining that the 12-month time bar applied to all claims under the shipbuilding contract. This is very much in line with previous case law to the effect that the purpose of the warranty clause is to limit the builder's exposure, in particular its temporal exposure, to claims for breach after delivery. In the Star Polaris, a case supported by the UK Defence Club, the court was clear on the substantive limitations of warranties. The court found that the warranty provision was a complete code and therefore excluded all liability of the builder after delivery, unless expressly provided for in the warranty. As the warranty clause did not contain any express agreement to cover the buyer's financial losses, consequential losses could not be claimed. The builder was only obliged to repair any defect, as expressly stated in the warranty clause. The buyer's attempt to expand the scope of the warranty therefore failed. Certain other limitations on the builder's warranty also exist. Normally, it applies only to defects discovered after delivery and acceptance of the ship. So there is an onus on a buyer either to reject or refuse delivery in the event of already known defects, or at least to expressly qualify any acceptance so that it operates without prejudice to the buyer's rights in respect to the defect. The temporal scope of warranties is normally interpreted strictly. Even if defects become apparent only after the end of the warranty period, the courts have generally found that the time bars preclude any claim by the buyer. Buyers frequently advance complex arguments of contractual construction in an attempt to expand claims, particularly as regards consequential losses. At times, the language of standard forms clearly precludes this. At other times, unclear language may give the buyer an opportunity for argument. However, the recent trend of arbitral decisions and court jurisprudence is against the buyer. Turning to price and payment, new building contracts generally work on the basis of a fixed price, with amendments only being possible in the event of modifications or to adjust for liquidated damages due from the builder for delay or deficiency. Price escalation clauses can be found in the CMAC form, but are not included in the SAJ or New Build Con forms. If a new build contract incorporates a price escalation clause, the parties should be clear both as to the trigger for escalation and the methodology of any calculation. New build contracts typically provide for staged payment arrangements between the buyer and the builder. A buyer's payments are usually tied to key milestone events in the construction process, such as commencement of steel cutting, keel laying, and launching. On achievement of the milestone event, the buyer's payment falls due within a specified number of days after a notification from the buyer. Provisions may be built into the notification process to provide additional comfort to a buyer, such as countersigning by the buyer's representative at the yard or confirmation by the classification society. Should a buyer's sign-off or similar be necessary, the buyer's representative should cooperate with the builder so as not to delay the process in the buyer's own interests. Now let's look at refund guarantees. A buyer's payments are often secured by a refund guarantee, generally provided by a bank. Buyers are understandably concerned about their exposure in the event that the builder becomes unable to complete construction, for example due to financial collapse. The recovery of deposits or staged payments in the event that the builder defaults on its obligations is a frequent source of disputes, and the wording of the refund guarantee can be of crucial importance in this respect. One particularly high-profile dispute, which was supported by the UK Defence Club, reached the Supreme Court. This was the case of Rainy Sky and Kookmin Bank. Rainy Sky had agreed to purchase a ship from a Korean yard. Payment of the first instalment was conditional upon provision by a first-class Korean bank of a refund guarantee, pursuant to which the bank committed to paying the buyer a refund if the ships were not built. Kookmin Bank provided advance payment bonds subject to English law, as did the refund guarantee. In a salutary lesson for the industry, the wording of the refund guarantee did not match the wording of the underlying shipbuilding contract. The shipbuilding contract provided for the refund guarantee to be triggered in the event that the yard entered into an insolvency procedure. However, the bonds did not. Under the bonds, the buyer would be entitled to a refund if it exercised its right to terminate, cancel, or rescind. The yard entered into insolvency proceedings before the ship was fully constructed. Rainy Sky attempted to trigger the refund from Cookmin, but was denied on the grounds that no right to terminate, rescind, or cancel had arisen. The saga went all the way to the Supreme Court and involved lengthy consideration of the principles of contractual construction. The Supreme Court concluded that a commercial construction should be applied in order to resolve the ambiguity. Business sense dictated that insolvency should trigger the refund guarantee. Indeed, this would be the most likely reason why a refund guarantee would be needed. Cookmin were therefore ordered to pay. Another point to note is that refund guarantees should clearly state that they remain valid, even if the new building contract is modified. Any material variation of the contract that potentially prejudices the guarantor and are made without the guarantor's consent will invalidate the refund guarantee. Parties should therefore exercise caution when drafting refund guarantees, ensuring that the contractual framework as a whole is reviewed. Disparity between contracts can lead to lengthy and very expensive legal disputes. We will now consider the question of contractual default. Shipbuilding contracts usually define stipulated events whereby either the buyer or the builder are in default. It is important that the scope and consequences of such events are clearly defined. With regard to buyer's default, provisions as to the nature of this will vary from contract to contract. Typically, however, a buyer will be in default if it fails to make timely payment of any instalment of the price or refuses to take delivery of the ship when properly tendered. The CMAC form requires written notice to the buyer, whereas under the SAJ form, default is an automatic process. The new build con does not set out a specific regime for buyer's default, but deals with it under the remedies available to the builder. Generally, the buyer becomes liable for interest and charges on late payments, but the builder is not excused from discharging its own obligations of construction. However, when the buyer's default continues for a specified period, for example, 15 days in the SAJ form, while the new build con has a longer period with more complex terms, the builder generally becomes entitled to terminate against notice to the buyer. Rescission by the builder can give rise to complex situations regarding instalments already paid and those due to be paid. A builder's default, as defined in the contract, may give the buyer a right to rescind. Such defaults will generally include serious technical deficiencies in the ship, delay in delivery beyond a particular point, financial defaults by the builder, such as the builder entering into liquidation, and the total loss of the ship prior to delivery. The issue of financial defaults can be particularly complex, given the varying restructuring and insolvency regimes that exist in different countries. In addition to the general liability for damages, in the event of the builder's default, many standard form contracts oblige the builder to refund to the buyer all monies already paid under the contract. Given the significant financial consequences for the builder, particularly if the builder is already in a financially stressed position, this can become highly contentious. Difficult issues can also arise about title to the ship, and this should be provided for in advance in clear contractual terms. Shipbuilding contracts normally provide detailed provisions for the timing of a ship's completion and delivery to the buyer. Delayed delivery is typically addressed by detailed liquidated damages clauses, with varying amounts becoming payable depending upon the length of the delay. The nature and complexity of shipbuilding is such that delay is likely, and neither a builder nor a buyer will wish to assume all risks associated with the delay. To address this problem, shipbuilding contracts typically provide for both permissible and impermissible delays. Permissible delays allow for the postponement of the delivery date. They're normally listed in the contract and are of a force majeure type relating to events outside the builder's control. Normally, a notification procedure must be followed if a builder wishes to rely on a stipulated force majeure event to postpone delivery. For instance, in the SAJ form, the builder must notify the buyer within 10 days from the occurrence of the stipulated event. The builder must then notify the buyer within a stipulated period after the end of the delaying event and advise of the extent of the delivery postponement with all reasonable dispatch. The buyer has a set time within which to object and risks being found to have waived its rights unless it does so promptly. Precise compliance with notification periods and time limits for providing notifications is very important, and non-compliance may bar a party from asserting its rights. In the case of impermissible delays, the builder normally becomes liable for liquidated damages. These accrue after an initial grace period, and again are normally subject to a long stop date, 180 days in the new build con and the SAJ forms. Once the maximum period is reached, the builder's liability to pay liquidated damages ends, and the buyer may be able to rescind the contract. The buyer may also then seek recovery of the sums paid by way of advance payments. Most shipbuilding contracts contain a drop-dead date or some form of long-stop provision. For example, in the SAJ form, the buyer may rescind the contract if the builder claims an extension in excess of 210 days in respect of specified force majeure events. Now let's look at some other matters to be found in new building contracts. A new build contract may contain options for further new builds, with the options to be exercised at contractually specified times. Such options can be a fertile source for disputes in a changing market, as both pricing and a yard's work and financial status may change between the negotiation of the contract and the exercise of the option. The case of TK Tankers and STX Offshore and Shipbuilding Co. illustrates the problems. Four shipbuilding contracts provided for options to build further ships, stating that best efforts would be used to deliver one ship in 2016 and the rest in 2017. The builder entered into a restructuring arrangement and was unable to secure sufficient credit for the required refund guarantees. The buyer rescinded the contracts and claimed damages for repudiation. At the same time, the buyer sought to exercise its option for a further eight ships. The yard was unable to perform the option agreements either, for obvious reasons, and the buyer sought to terminate the option agreements and claim damages for repudiatory breach by the builder. The court considered that the option agreements failed for uncertainty. The parties had intended them to be binding, but had failed to specify delivery dates. The court considered that this uncertainty could not be overcome by the use of implied terms. Again, this is a reminder to parties of the need for clear and specific contractual provisions. Turning to law and jurisdiction clauses, English law and jurisdiction, whether in court or arbitration, is a popular choice in new building contracts. However, other choices are common and may be dictated by the location of the parties. In any event, it is important that clear provisions are included in order to avoid a dispute as to which court or tribunal has jurisdiction over the matter, and what law is to be applied to the contract. Other related contracts, for example contracts for the purchase, delivery and fitting of marine equipment, may be subject to different legal and jurisdictional regimes to that of the shipbuilding contract. This means that disputes may not be back-to-back, and there can be added complexity and cost due to the involvement of different jurisdictions. Parties should be aware of this as a potential pitfall. With regard to other contracts, subcontractors are commonly used in shipbuilding. The contract should stipulate the permissible extent of subcontracting and ensure that liability remains with the builder throughout. The usual practice is for the builder to seek the buyer's approval for the use of subcontractors, with such approval not to be unreasonably withheld. A pre-approved makers list setting out authorised subcontractors and suppliers can speed the process along. There are a number of circumstances in which the buyer's rights may be against the subcontractor itself. Tortious claims against a negligent subcontractor may be possible. Similarly, in certain circumstances, the buyer may be able to rely on the Contracts Rights of Third Parties Act to pursue claims against a subcontractor. Builders may also, as regards the post-delivery period, assign the benefits of guarantees from subcontractors to the buyer. Now, what if the buyer wishes to assign the shipbuilding contract? The ability for the buyer to assign a contract can be very important, particularly in a rising market. Most contracts permit assignment, provided the shipyard's consent is obtained, with that consent not to be unreasonably withheld. Under English law, it is only possible to assign the benefits of a contract and not the burdens. This means that where there is to be an assignment, the builder cannot be obliged to accept a guarantee from another third party or bank. Therefore, the original buyer may have continuing obligations and/or rights under the contract, irrespective of the assignment. It may, for instance, be obliged to pursue claims under any builder's warranties for the benefit of the ultimate buyer. It may also be possible to agree that a novation agreement is signed instead. This is essentially a tripartite document between the builder, the buyer, and the ultimate buyer, whereby all rights and obligations of the original buyer are transferred to the ultimate buyer. We hope that this summary is of interest. To conclude, we would emphasise that parties to a new building contract should use clear contractual terms to avoid disputes and ensure that the contract runs smoothly. Where disputes do develop, they can be costly and complex, and members are advised to seek legal advice and assistance from the club at an early stage. Thank you for your time in listening to this podcast.